All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
This is NPR News. I'm Angela Davis. Glad you could join us. This fall, many students and educators returned to the classroom for the first time since the pandemic began. A challenging school year lies ahead. We know that schools are facing significant staffing shortages as the COVID-19 Delta variant spreads. And families are coping with the continued impact of the pandemic on their finances, their social lives, and their mental health. For NPR's latest In Focus event, I talk with people who work in education about the return to the classroom and how we can work together to prevent Minnesota's disparities in educational outcomes from worsening. And I want to introduce our guests right now. We have with us Natalia Benjamin. Natalia is an ethnic studies and multilingual learners teacher at Century High School in Rochester. She was named Minnesota Teacher of the Year in 2021. Hi, Natalia, and congratulations on your award.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here today.
Nice to see you. We also have with us Katie Almendarez, the CEO of Minnesota Care Partner. Now, that is a group that works to tackle racial disparities with a focus on mental health. And Katie is also a licensed clinical social worker and the parent of two students in Minneapolis Public Schools. Hi there, Katie.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Good to see your face. And we have Michael Walker with us, the director of the Office of Black Student Achievement for Minneapolis Public Schools. Michael is also the founder of Critical Questioning Consulting, and it is good to talk to you again, Michael.
Thank you, Angela. Nice to be here today with you all.
Michael, I'll start with you because you were a guest with us here on In Focus 1 year ago when we were talking about education and what is happening in schools. And so back then, we were in the very early months of the pandemic. So I'm curious about your thoughts on what's different now than what students were facing a year ago.
Oh, my. When you ask that question, it makes me try to remember what did I say a year ago, because we all were trying to figure out how to keep our heads and how to make sure we were able to transition to a new form of learning. And so what I will say that kind of stands out to me is that there's been other options that have presented themselves of ways to connect with students and families, right? And so one of those things is that we have technology and we've figured out how to use that technology. And so how do we keep using that technology in a way that benefits our students when there are instances where they cannot be physically in school? There has been a huge increase, I want to say, in the fact that when we were in this distance learning world, that families had access to the teachers and educational system because class was happening right inside their homes. Their mm-hmm. teachers were delivering that instruction to their kids with families all being present. And so those are just a couple of the things that I've noticed as a difference that we can kind of lean on to continue in the educational world.
So we've learned some things, but just as people, we're beaten down. I mean, we're worn down too.
For sure. I mean, for sure. It's all about trying to, one thing that I would say is how do we give ourselves and each other grace through this process, right? Because we have experienced a pandemic that has been traumatic for many of our people in our community. And we don't know what that looks like for each individual child or each individual person, because we also have to think about the adults who are coming back to teach and lead buildings in our educational world. They have also experienced in that pandemic in certain ways, because they have families. They may have lost loved ones due to the due to the coronavirus. And so leading with grace and trying to re-engage each other through a relational approach, I think, is really the way to go about doing this, because then it starts us off in a space where we're not trying to just get back to business as usual, because this is not usual. This has not been a normal last 18 or so months.
Natalia, you're a teacher there in the Rochester School District. How do you describe the impact of this prolonged pandemic, these long periods of distance learning that some students endured? What are you seeing in the classrooms, and what are you hearing from other teachers about what they're seeing?
Yeah, no, I think I echo what Michael was talking about. It's different this year, right? Our students are coming back. Having lived through a lot of different things, many families have suffered a lot of loss, whether it was personal or family members or just the disruption to their lives. And we're seeing that with students coming back. They're self-reporting that they're tired, right? There's lack of sleep is still a thing. And I think they're trying to figure out how to navigate this in-person world again. For such a long time, they were isolated in their homes. And so now having to be face-to-face to people is different and it's new. And we need to take that into consideration as we're coming back in person. When I asked them how they're doing in the morning, some mentioned stressed. It's stressful to be around so many people, and that's a real thing for them. And so there's a lot of stresses and forces in their lives, and I think it's important to acknowledge that as we go back in person, because they have a lot of worries still, even though we're trying to be back to quote normal, right? There's still a lot going on in their heads and in their hearts.
You mentioned that they are tired. Now, I know with high school students, many high school students took on jobs, and many of them are continuing to work. And we know that being tired and the sleep disruptions, that gets in the way of learning.
Absolutely. In fact, before school started, I had several students who messaged me asking about, can I switch my 8-hour class so I can leave to make it on time to work? And so we still have a lot of high school age students who are going to work 6, 7, 8 hours after they get done with school, and then they do it all over again the next day. So it's definitely trying to balance that part of life. Some of them have a choice. Some of them have to work to either help their families or make ends meet themselves. And so it's definitely an added stressor in their lives.
And so how are you seeing education disparities? You know, how does that show up in the classroom as we look at just the effect of this pandemic so far?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that we're carrying over from the pandemic year. Some students had a really hard time engaging virtually through class, and now we have to find ways to help them attain those credits so that they can get to graduation. And when they don't have a lot of time, when they have to work outside their home, when maybe they have responsibilities, some of them have to go back home and babysit so that their parents can go to work. There's not a lot of time to be able to make up for those disruptions from previous years. But in addition to that, we know that communities of color were affected at larger rates than other communities. And that's something that will show up as we have students with more social emotional needs. Mm-hmm. They might have a harder time focusing in school. And we know that those stressors show up with our behaviors. And so it's important to keep that in mind as we're trying to work through the content and the things that we want them to learn in school. One thing is just having to slow down. We're having to go back and relearn some of the basics and how we do some of the things we were used to doing 2 years ago. And so just slowing down a little bit so that we can kind of get our bearings so that we can move forward.
I like hearing slow down. we really don't have a choice. We've got to slow down. Katie, you work at Minnesota Care Partner. You're focused on mental health. How do you describe the impact of this prolonged pandemic, prolonged periods of distance learning, and just the stress that students and teachers are under?
Yeah, there's a collective trauma that we are seeing within students, especially students of color. And there's, you know, after all of the isolation and, you know, depending on what's going on at home in their home life, and a lot of students relied on school for food, safety, to get basic needs met, to have that social connection. And so this has been building up for a long time. And then people who don't have access to technology so that they can keep up on those those skills, it's really impacting their mental health and their anxiety. And people are, we're just seeing a lot of mental health concerns come up. And then we know that mental health interferes, trauma and mental health interferes with IQ. And so that is contributing to this achievement gap and the divide. So the mental health piece is really pivotal in terms of addressing the achievement gap.
Michael, when you hear the term learning loss, what do you make of that term? I mean, how do we describe what is happening with our kids in terms of falling behind?
Yeah, that term doesn't necessarily sit well with me, because the reason why I say that is when we think about what took place, educators had to pivot and move in a way that was like instantaneously, right? And so what we really did was saved learning, because we were going to be out of school. We were going to not have the traditional access that we had been so accustomed to of being face-to-face with students and educators, having that, that face-to-face time. And so now we have put this deficit term on it, right? Learning loss. I want to try to put a different angle on it, says learning saved, because it could have been much worse if we hadn't moved and pivoted the way education did, right?
And why is that mindset so critical, that it's saved learning and not learning loss? Because I know we're trying to avoid hopelessness and making it feel like it's a goal we just can't possibly achieve. Is that why it's key, how we frame it, the language we use?
For sure it's key, right? Because what we have to realize is that our young people are hearing these messages. So they're hearing these things that we keep talking about in the media. They're hearing these things that we're talking about in our staff meetings or department meetings, and we keep talking about this negative learning loss, learning loss, learning loss. Well, now I start to internalize that as like, well, I didn't do it with my part. I didn't learn anything. And so now it starts to create a space where I disengage from education even more. Right. So our role should be saying, how do we engage them in the process? How do we provide some sense of support that they are assets, that they are valuable, that they did take on some responsibilities that no other child has done in our recent history to be able to continue going to school and gain that learning? Right. So those things are very fundamental to me. And it goes to what Katie is talking about around this mental health. Right. So if we continue to talk about this deficit, well, that has to seep into the minds of our young people, that seeps into the minds of our educators. And now we start to view education in a way that is hopeless. And so we have to change that so that we don't view it as hopelessness, but that we have an ability to do something about it, right? We have to be manufacturers of hope.
Natalia, what are your thoughts on that? Are students paying attention to how we talk about the situation that we're in?
Absolutely. And I think the language we use is important. And many times we forget to highlight the things that we did well and that students learned through that year. The way that we can use technology right now is we are years beyond where we would have been had this not happened. Our students are able to have, you know, we're our one-to-one devices, where before the pandemic, that was a dream. We didn't think that was something that we would be able to do. And so there are some things that allowed us to fine-tune some things that before we didn't think we were going to be able to do. And so I love seeing the things that we were able to do. So technology was one of them. I think we were better at figuring out communication and how to contact families and others that maybe we didn't have to before. And so building on those things, because even if we were not able to learn all the content we would have had in an in-person year, I think I love that idea that we save some learning and we can build on those skills. That our young people are going to make up, right? The addition, the reading, that they're going to be able to do that. If we see them in a year or two, they're going to learn the things that they need to do. And I think it's important for us to provide them with what they need right now so that they can have that learning happen. I know Katie was mentioning, you know, the impact of trauma and of mental health. And I think it's important for us to set up the education system in the right way so that those services are available for the people that need it the most, so that then we can work on the learning pieces and other aspects of it. But we did learn a lot of life lessons too. And I think it's important to remind our students of those things and to value the things that they were able to do during this past year.
And Katie, I know that you have to leave us early. I just want to ask you before you go, you know, how much do you feel that school districts are listening to parents and families, especially parents and families of color? And is there more that school districts could be doing to support the mental health of students and their families?
Yeah, I apologize. I had a friend pass, so I'm a little distracted today. Can you please repeat that question? I do want to address it.
Yeah, I'm very sorry on the passing of your friend. And I just want to know, is there any advice that you would offer school districts or families to support children right now in class?
Yeah, mental health is huge. And so funding, offering therapy and CTSS skills in the school to make it accessible. I think that a big problem is that there is not representation of Black and Brown providers. And so that also impacts the way that students are disciplined or responded to in the classroom. And so it's really important that funding is a priority for mental health in the schools, because if people are anxious and stressed out, or there's trauma and it's not being treated, then that interferes with learning and continues to exacerbate the achievement gap in Minnesota.
All right. That's Katie Amendaris, the CEO of Minnesota Care Partner, a group that works to tackle mental health issues and racial disparities as we look at education. And Katie, I'm so sorry about the loss that you're dealing with. Thank you for your time with us this afternoon. We're going to let you go. Natalia, as we talk about what's happening in this transition back to the classroom, I just want to hear, like, what are you seeing in terms of student behavior and focus? Because, you know, I'm sure they want to socialize, right? They've been away from their friends. I mean, what are you seeing as you're trying to kind of, you know, maintain order and get them listening to you in class?
Sure. I think, yes, they want to socialize. I think they're happy to see their friends. But within the classroom setting, I think it's really hard for them to be out there, raise their hand and participate. I think that's something that that we need to make a priority so that we can help them figure out those skills again. Because like I said before, this past year, right, they were home, they were isolated, and they had limited opportunities to be able to participate live and in groups. And so that's something that we're trying to help our students work on as well. And then I think the other part is, it's different being at home, right? And studying, being able to maybe be in the living room or being in your bedroom to learn, and now having to be at school for 8 hours a day, mm-hmm. And being on, right, all the time. And I think that's something that that we need to work through as well. And so by the time it's the end of the day, I think many of our students are tired, right? Their stamina is, they don't have the stamina to sustain 8 hours of just sitting on a desk, because we have limited opportunities to move around due to, right, distancing. And we still have a lot of disruptions happening currently. And so it's different. It's where we're trying to work through those. And at least in my classes, I'm trying to work on community building so that we can get to know each other, and so that we can build a support network, and at the same time work on that stamina so that we can do that.
Do you feel like at this point, should we be less focused on learning and just, you know, again, maintaining, surviving, being supportive? I mean, we saw an example just now, you know, Katie came with the intention of being with us, and, you know, she's dealing with a sudden loss of life of a close friend, you know, so there's just so much coming at us so quickly that it's hard to follow through, even if you have the best intentions.
Absolutely. And I think in addition to that, right, we have students who maybe family members are testing positive to COVID, or their friends are, or who have to quarantine. And so there is a lot of worries and a lot of other things that they are dealing with. And so I think it's important to take that time to acknowledge where everybody's at.
And Michael, I know you're very big on, like, just moving and having grace. And what are your thoughts about just really, you know, for many kids, school may be the only place where someone asks you, like, how are you doing? And what should educators be keeping in mind as they interact with students? Is it more about, you know, right now learning, or is it about just let's get through this?
I think both can happen simultaneously. And what I mean by doing a little bit of both is that students have learned so many new skills throughout the pandemic that we're not even able to conceptualize how that will play out in the future. We don't know the outcome for that. So I'm assuming there's going to be a lot of studies done on students who are like just entering kindergarten, who started off in the virtual space and now they've moved to face to face. How do they show up later in life, right? Because there may be some skill sets that they have acquired from that experience that may push our generation, push our society into a whole nother another stratosphere around this use of technology, right? And so if we slow down in our spaces to really build community, to really build the climate and culture where we can have some of these deep level conversations, and then we can move on to some learning. We know, as Katie was kind of alluding to earlier about trauma and mental health, if I'm having that and experiencing that, it's very difficult for me to learn and keep new information, right?
To
so
focus,
it has a
right?
direct impact. Yeah, it has a direct impact on the learning outcomes. And so we have to address that if we want to address the academic components to that.
Natalia, you're a native Spanish speaker who grew up learning French in Guatemala, I'm told, and now you teach English to multilingual students there in Rochester. What do we need to be aware of when it comes to the needs of students who are learning English?
I think it's important to, and we've talked about this, it's just that communication piece with our families, because a lot gets lost in, you know, when we're doing everything through email and a lot of that communication with our families. And so being cognizant of the different language that maybe schools should be using to communicate. When it comes to the students, they may have other challenges because of where they are in life and trying to access, you know, the different services. We've been talking about opportunity gaps and how that plays out within what they can do in the schools. I try really hard to provide supports, language supports, so that language is not the the barrier to their learning. And I'm actually very impressed with the work that they're doing. I think once we are able to provide those scaffolds, they're rising up to the occasion.
I want to bring in a question from one of our audience members as we talk with Michael Walker. They are the director of the Office of Black Student Achievement at Minneapolis Public Schools, and Natalia Benjamin. They're a teacher at Century High School in Rochester, as well as Minnesota's current Teacher of the Year. Catherine is asking this: how do you think the additional federal funding related to COVID should be best spent to help close the racial and ethnic achievement gap in education? So additional federal funding. Michael, do you want to try to answer that for us?
In the past, we have done these like blanketed opportunities for students, and we're going to use this funding to do whatever we're going to, whatever strategy that we're going to use. What we have to do is be more targeted, right? And it's okay to target specific minoritized and marginalized populations and say, we're going to do this for Black students, whatever that is. And we have to be okay with that. And the reason why that is really important to me is that when we think about the historical pieces that has happened in our nation, is that we have created laws and policies and statutes that were specifically against certain marginalized, minoritized populations in our community, right? So if that was a way to create some of the disparities and barriers that we have, then we have to use a similar strategy to get rid of those barriers and obstacles that are in the way. And so we have to be more targeted. Saying, this is who these funds are for. This is what these funds are going to do. And we have to be okay with that if we're truly trying to have more equitable outcomes. Because I think sometimes we get confused with equity and equality. Like, we want everything to be equal. But if we're trying to make things equitable, that means some people are going to have to get more than others in order to bring that group up to a level playing field. And sometimes I think that's where the conversation starts to wane a little bit, where folks are a little nervous to say certain things. But I'm saying we have to be more targeted in our approach and say who those dollars are for, say what those dollars are going to do, and be okay with that as we are attacking those racial disparities.
And Natalia, anything that you want to respond to as Catherine asked about this additional federal funding related to COVID and how it can be used to address the achievement gap?
My understanding is part of it has been used to provide technology for students. And I think a large amount of the funding has gone to that in the past year. But as we move forward, I think we need to think about what our students haven't had been access to in the past. And so that can be some of the extracurriculars. That can be sometimes it's transportation to communities who are within walking distance, but yet that's a barrier to get to school. Transportation is a huge barrier to our students having access to some of, like, getting home after extracurriculars or being able to do other things like that. Another thing that I keep thinking about is, like, our students who have to work and therefore don't have access for other things. What if it was like a sort of like when we do in college for some of our students, where it's like a work learning opportunity so that they can still have the income that they need and they're working and being able to make an impact in our community, but they're also learning through that process. And I would just go back to we need more mental health professionals in our schools. We need to be able to provide the services that our students need within our schools. If every school could be a community school, and so that not just our students but our families receive the services that they needed on site, I think that would go a long way to meeting a lot of the basic needs that would change the trajectory of mm-hmm. achievement.
I want to talk about staff shortages. I read some of these stories in the newspaper, and I just get upset. We know about the shortage of substitute teachers. That was already a problem before the pandemic. And now the shortage of school bus drivers, also already a problem before the pandemic. Both of you are parents. So what are you experiencing both as a parent and as an educator, Michael, when it comes to the shortage of school bus drivers? What can you share with us about that?
I just got to take deep breaths because sometimes I get those calls that saying that my child is not going to have a bus to get home or is not going to have a bus to go to school that day. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough and privileged enough that I work in the district that my children attend. So I'm able to transport them to and from school. However, there's many people in our community who don't have that privilege, who are not capable of doing that. And so that has definitely been a barrier for students getting to and from school. But there are always some like silver linings that come out of these situations, and you start to see how community takes care of community, right? And so there have been spots where community is stepping up and helping transport kids to and from school as a collective, right? And so one parent may not be able to do it, but they have partnered with another family who attends school, live in the same neighborhood, and they're able to drop the children off or pick the children up. And so, again, these glimmers of hope or these glimmers of, hey, we know how to be a community when it's time to be a community. And so how do we build upon those things as we are figuring out this new way of being in education? And as we talk about community, when we go back to how those funds should be used in order to address some of these racial and ethnic gaps that we see in our educational system, well, how are we bringing the community perspective into the conversation as we're making those decisions, right? We have to believe in education that we know that the families, the parents are the first teachers of their children. And say so they know what's best. They know how to engage their child. They know what levers to pull or things to do that will get their student engaged in learning. And so how can we partner intentionally with those families, with those communities, and bring them to the table and let them really lead that charge on how we should be spending these monies? What are some new, innovative, creative ways that we can try to address some of these disparities that we may haven't done in the past, right? And allow that to lead some of the dialogue and conversation. My thing is that we've already been doing some of these things over and over again, and we've seen the results. And many times the results haven't been good, right? So why are we going to continuously do that same thing over? Let's try something new. Now, am I saying that it's 100% going to work? No, but at least we're trying something new to try to get a different outcome, to try to make it better for our students, to try to make it better for our families, to try to make it better for our community. And so I really push that way of being is let's try some new things. If it doesn't work, let's get the learning from that. And then let's adjust and try something else.
Tell me about the substitute teacher situation, because, you know, people are getting sick, people are dealing with family emergencies. And is it true there just aren't enough substitutes? And then what happens?
Yeah, for sure. There's not enough subs for all those reasons that you just highlighted, Angela. And really what happens is the community in the school takes up, right? They show up and support one another. So you have teachers who will miss their preps in order to help out in another classroom. You have other support staff who will step in and support in classrooms when the numbers are not there. And so it's a whole effort. You have administrators who will step into the classroom and teach those classes and be with those students. And so it's really like, how do we be flexible and nimble? And how do we take care of each other? And how do we ensure that our community is getting the best that we can provide and offer? And it's really, again, starting to build this community. I don't want to put it like it's, you know, like everything is all great and there's no issues or confusion or frustrations throughout that process, because there are, because we're human. But at the end of the day, if we can keep centering that we are trying to be responsive to the needs of our students, then we can get to those decisions where we can step up and support in ways that we have to. Thinking about the transportation issue, right? We have building administrators, counselors, social workers who are having to stay after school for many, many hours to ensure that these young people are being picked up.
Yes, I want to say thank you to everybody who's doing extra. Thank you. I want to read a note from an audience member. When I said staff shortages, everybody's like, oh, yeah. And Natalia, before I get to you, so an audience member is writing this. The staffing shortage is such a serious problem. I work for a school district and we have had jobs posted since the middle of summer that are still not filled. We have vacancies in school nurse positions, teaching, bus drivers, childcare, food service, and administration. And we are all trying to do our jobs plus cover for these vacancies. Please encourage people to apply to work for schools so they can be part of the solution. Natalia, what are you seeing, again, as a mom, as a teacher, when it comes to the school bus driver shortage and the substitute teacher shortage?
Yeah, some of the same things that Michael mentioned. And I think even with the support staff, yes, there's many positions that are still open and that haven't been applied to. And I think back of this extra funding, can some of the funding go so that some of the support staff have living wages, right? That they're encouraged to come to our schools, because their jobs they're doing are important. Like there's many things that we cannot do without them, especially in the world of special education. And so it's important for us to reflect on that as well. And maybe if we don't have the people that are applying, a lot of times is they may not have the credentials to do that, right? Like if you want to be a bus driver, what are the requirements to do that? For teaching positions, what are the requirements to do that? So can we provide some financial support for people to get the credentials that we need so that they can be in our schools? And I think that's at all levels of the positions that are open. You know, we keep talking about mental health professionals and nurses. Everybody's stretched really thin right now. And I think if we had some of those other supports that may encourage people that may not be in the profession yet to come and join us in the school system.
Michael and Natalia, I want to read another comment from an audience member, a question. I hear from my friends who are teachers that they are overwhelmed by parents' needs, parents' questions, concerns, and criticisms during this time. What is helpful and what is hurtful as far as parents communicating with teachers regarding their kids? Parents, we can be a whole lot in trying to help. Natalia, what can parents do, or do parents need an awareness, right? It's not just you and your child going through this thing. It's everyone going through it.
Yeah, no, I think that that communication line is important. We know parents want the best for their children. And sometimes, you know, there's frustration when we don't know what's happening on either side. And so I think asking questions like, can you help me understand, you know, why something's happening, or my child doesn't know what they need to do. Can you help me understand what the process is so that we can find together what they need to do? You know, teachers, there's a wide range of expertise when it comes to technology. There's a wide range of classes. You know, some of us are teaching many different classes throughout the day. Other ones are, maybe they have the same content, but several with many more students. And so I think it's important for just to ask questions and keep that line of communication open. I know teachers can get overwhelmed because, right, when we're taking preps to fill into to other teachers' classes, the grading might take longer. Like we might not be able to get to some things as timely as we would love to, because of all these other extra things that are happening due to COVID. And so I think it's important to just keep asking questions and communicating in a way that there's open dialogue between everybody, because we all want what's best for the students.
Michael, an opportunity to speak to parents who have questions, concerns, criticisms. Any advice you'd offer on how to communicate or interact with the folks inside your child's school?
Yeah, I think Natalia hit on a lot of great points around asking questions. And what I would add to that is the way you're asking those questions, right? What sentiment is it coming from? How is your tone? How how are you approaching this teacher? Because again, we are all dealing with this pandemic at the same exact time. And you have no idea what people are going through or what is occurring with them in that moment. So if we can do what Natalia and Katie talked about earlier, slow down. Mm-hmm. We can slow down for a second. And before we submit that question through email, let's type it out or whatever, and then reread it. Give yourself 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes. Go back and reread it. See what the tone is. See if that is even something I need to be asking at this moment, because maybe it could be something that can wait. But sometimes we need to get our things out, and sometimes we hit send too fast, or we pick up the phone and dial the number too fast. I think we have to slow down a bit before we just reach out and really think through, what is this question that I'm thinking that I need answered? Why does it need to be answered? How am I delivering the question to the person that I'm hoping to answer that space? On the other side, as educators, we need to be mindful and thoughtful that parents will have questions. They will be frustrated. I don't know where my child is when the bus doesn't pick up at the school to drop my kid off at home. Yeah, I may be a little up in arms, or I may have some anxiety because I'm confused and not knowing. And so when we have the opportunity, how can we also try to de-escalate those situations and bring people to a calmer space versus escalating the situation and meeting it with that same fire that may be coming? And so am I asking a little bit of the educators to be thoughtful and mindful? Yes, I am asking that of educators. I think we have that that ability, that tool, because we have kids in front of us all hours of the day. And so we have that skill set that we can utilize when we're communicating with parents and families. So let's kind of use that as well to de-escalate, to be able to get to a space where we can have a conversation that is actually impactful, and we can get some information out of it versus this adversarial space that could tend to show up.
Because they don't know. I mean, like, you might want to be careful when you step to Mr. Walker or to Ms. Benjamin, because, you know, they may have had to drive some people some places, and you don't know what people have gone through when you have that initial contact. Speaking of that, and just, you know, parents and some of the things that we've seen in terms of behavior, what do you all make of what is going on in school board meetings? I mean, this has been happening across the nation at school board meetings where parents are showing up. And just, we've seen outbursts, screams, threats towards school board members, people who've just reached the end of the rope. But, you know, I've never seen anything like it in my career as a journalist. What do you think of it as an educator, seeing school board meetings become so chaotic? Natalia?
It's really hard for me to understand how we got to that point. I think we have the young people are watching, and I believe that regardless of what our position is, we can do that with civil discourse. We can present our points without having to put other people down. We can present our perspectives without threatening people and without having behavior that's not conducive to dialogue. And so I think it's important for us to model like what we would love our students to do and our children in our society. And I think to remember that sometimes I feel we get so caught up in the philosophies of what's this and what's that. And I think we need to go back of how this affects individuals. At the end of the day, what is the best thing for individuals and to be safe and to be in a space where they can learn for our students and to take into account our community. Just because I may not have high risk factors does not mean somebody else in my community doesn't. And I think I would love for us to come back to a place where we're thinking of a community as a whole and how we can help and support each other, because screaming and throwing fits is not going to get us there. And we need, I think our students are ready for us to just be supportive of each other and helping each other so that we can get through this pandemic.
The first thing Natalia said, Michael, is students are watching. I can't imagine, like, Grandma, was that you on the news yelling at the school board member? I mean, what kind of messages are some of these parents sending to students about how to behave and how to talk and how to communicate?
Yeah, the kids are always watching, right? And they are, as Natalia said earlier, we're modeling for them on how to act and how to behave. And I want to be really clear is that I'm not here to say that I don't want people to be passionate about certain topics or certain things that move them and what they want school boards to do. So I'm all for passion and excitement and energy. But again, just kind of really building on what Natalia said is that we can do that in a way that is respectful and not demeaning to others and not talking down to people. And really, that's kind of the bare minimum that we should be expecting from each other, as well as we're talking about what, you know, people are on different sides of the aisle, so to speak. We have to get to a space where we're talking about collectivism, right? As a collective, what is best for us as a collective, right? Because some of these individual things, yeah, so I may not be a high risk and yada, yada, yada for COVID. However, as Natalia said, there may be some folks in my community, in the schools that my kids attend. And so how can we be mindful and protective of all of us so that we all make it out of this, not just a select few? And so that's kind of where I stand with all of this, is that I want to do what's best for all of us to be mindful. And I'm willing to err on the side of caution, right? I'm willing to err on the side of caution for that to occur. And that's where kind of how I look at it. And I'm hoping that people will be willing to err on the side of caution, even if it's a little bit of an inconvenience. Because if we think about inconveniences and whatnot, we have a lot of minoritized and marginalized groups who have been inconvenienced by this system and not because of mass mandates or whatever the case may be. There was some real physical harm and violence that was done.
A lot of the outbursts we've seen at school board meetings were over mask mandates. And so I'm just curious about what is it like inside of a high school or middle school right now where masks are required? Are the students complying? Or I mean, what are you seeing or what can you tell us about what you're hearing as far as the masks go? Michael?
Yeah, of course. For the most part, students are complying, right? But just like with anyone, does it get hot under that mask sometimes? Yes. Will they slip and pull it down to catch a full breath of air and then pull it back up? Yeah, that happens. That occurs. But for the most part, students are being mindful. They are wearing their mask. I haven't heard of any huge issues of students not, at least in the district that I work in. I haven't heard any huge issues, but folks are really being mindful of it. And I think it all depends on how you're delivering that message. As you're engaging with students who may have their masks down, am I barking orders at them or am I talking to them as young adults, young people saying, hey, so, you know, we got to pull our mask up. We're just trying to make sure everybody is safe. So can you pull your mask up over your mouth and nose? Boom. right? But if I'm yelling down the hallway, hey, take care, put your mask, well, those two delivery styles are going to give two different reactions from students and people. And so I think we have the ability to create the climate and culture that we want by how we deliver the messages, by how we're sharing the insight with our students and families and explaining why we are making these decisions, right? Because I think that's what people just want to know, what they want to be in and know. They want to understand why. And typically, I would have to say that most folks are understanding when we provide that insight information to them.
And Natalia, what can you tell us about Rochester Public Schools? Are the students required to wear masks? Is it heavily recommended? And are they doing it?
Yes. So in our district, we are wearing masks indoors. And like Michael said, the large majority of them are complying. And I think the why goes a long way, right? I have a co-teacher who is immunocompromised. And we talk about that in the classroom. Why is it important for all of us to wear a mask so that we can protect each other and that we can all be safe? And I think we just have to keep having those conversations. And I think most students, if we remind them, right, cover your nose and your mouth, they'll pull up their mask and do it. There may be some few instances where students may react negatively. And I think it's important to work with the families in that respect. And so to understand where that's coming from. I think especially for our students who may have sensory issues or other difficulties so that we can work with them. However, the large majority, I think, of students are able to do this in a safe manner. Yes, it's uncomfortable when students are running back from places and they're sweaty and itchy, right? They're really good about asking for a different mask and other things. Again, that line of communication is super important with families so that if there are concerns that we can address those. And many times parents might say, I will have that conversation with my child so that he can make the right choices and so that we can find solutions together.
All right. I want to bring in one last question from an audience member. This is Marty asking a great question. He wants to know, Michael and Natalia, what are you most hopeful for the rest of the school year? What are you hopeful about? Michael, what are you hopeful about?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
We're just starting.
Sometimes it's hard to think about that as you're just beginning to start the school year. But I guess really what I'm hopeful about is that we're able to complete a full school year of in face-to-face. I'm hopeful that the policies and protocols that we have put in place will actually be able to keep our students and our staff safe enough for us to have a full in-person school year where students can participate in the extracurricular activities, whether that be, you know, band, drama, sports, chess clubs, and that sort of thing, so they can get that full experience. Because we have to really think about, there are some students who are new to this school space. And what I mean by that, we have like ninth graders in high school and sophomores in high school who are new to what high school is like. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, sixth and seventh graders who are in middle school who are learning what it's like to be in middle school. And we have kindergartners and first graders who are learning what it's like to be in school at the first outset. So there's a whole lot of newness that is going on for some very targeted groups. And so how do we make sure that they have a really good first opportunity, first experience in those spaces with schooling? And so that I'm hopeful that will occur throughout the year.
Marty is asking, what are you hopeful for the rest of the school year? Natalia, tell us.
I think I'm hopeful to see the growth that we're going to go through this year. It's always fun to get to the end of the school year, the semester, and be able to see, look where we started, and let's reflect on the growth that we've done this year. And so I'm hopeful that we can get our routines down, that we can get into some sort of system so that we can all just have that security, right, in knowing what's going to happen every day. And that's been something we've missed for the last, through the pandemic, because we got sent home. We thought we were going to come back and we didn't. We were virtual. We were hybrid. We were in person. Like, we just kept changing things. And so I'm hopeful that we can get into a routine that we can grow into so that we can have a successful school year and reflect on our growth in May and June.
Yeah, and I wasn't asked, but I'm just hopeful that, yeah, we can continue with the in-person learning. I'm hopeful that we see more people like the two of you continue to work in education, choose to work in education, and to that you continue to lead and you know, bring that compassion to your job as well as all the training that you have. Our time is up for now. Thanks to all of you for sharing your insight with us. We've been talking with Natalia Benjamin, an ethnic studies and multilingual learners teacher at Century High School in Rochester. She was named Minnesota Teacher of the Year in 2021, as well as Michael Walker, the director of the Office of Black Student Achievement for the Minneapolis Public Schools and founder of Critical Questioning Consulting. And earlier, we talked with Katie Amanderis, the CEO of Minnesota Care Partner, a group that works to tackle racial disparities with a focus on mental health. This In Focus event was produced by NPR's Gregory Smith, Samantha Matsumoto, and Tom Campbell. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.